provided on this show is for entertainment and educational purposes only. The financial ideas and strategies discussed are only provided as a starting point for a conversation about money matters. With regard to your particular investments and financial strategies, consult your financial planner, CPA, or investment professional. All your financial decisions are yours and yours alone to make and subsequently are solely your responsibility. The information that is supplied through the context of the radio program and any repurposing of its content by the host or network is a combination and collection of solid financial investment understanding, opinion, and comments. This network, show, and its host are not liable for financial strategies, outcomes that you employ in any manner that result in any kind of loss. Shares of corporate sponsors may be the subject of buy or sell recommendations in Jay Taylor's newsletter in accordance with Jay's objective opinion.
Welcome to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with your host, Jay Taylor. This hour will help investors fix issues and achieve personal gain. Now, here's your host, Jay Taylor.
Welcome to Turning Hard Times into Good Times. I am your host, Jay Taylor, and I'm speaking to you from New York City on this, the 9th day of July, 2019. I do like to remind you that I am the editor of a newsletter called Jay Taylor's Gold, Energy, and Tech Stocks, and we're focused primarily on the junior mining sector, exploration stocks, probably 90% of the stocks that I cover. And there's some really exciting things going on these days. A few of those companies that I follow are sponsors to this show, and we'll be talking to one in a little while, Strike Point Gold. Sean Kuhn will be with me, as will today. Also, we'll also have with me Alistair McLeod and Michael Oliver. I should also mention that Chen Lin is vacationing for about a month and a half or so in Asia with his family. He'll be visiting, actually, Novo Resources Project in Western Australia, and we look forward to talking to Chen when he comes back about that. And he also is plugged in very well to his friends and his connections in China, which we'll also want to ask Chen about when he comes back. If you don't want to wait for Chen on the radio show, you might consider subscribing to his newsletter. Chen, you can go to chenpicks.com. The letter is What is Chen Buying? What is Chen Selling? Has had a stellar record, especially in the biotech space, but also with energy and also with gold and silver mining stocks. So What is Chen Buying? What is Chen Selling? chenpicks.com. My letter, you can go to miningstocks.com to subscribe to that. Jay Taylor's Gold, Energy, and Tech Stock, or you can call our office here in New York City, 718-457-1426, 718-457-1426. Of course, I want to thank you for listening to this show, making it one of the more popular shows on the Voice America Business Channel. Also want to thank our sponsors for making this show economically viable. Our sponsors this week are Klondike Gold, Novo Resources, RN Resources, Strike Point Gold, and Radisson Mining Resources. I've titled today's show, The Impact of Financial Wars on Gold. Alistair McLeod will be with us. Sean Kuhn, as I just noted, and Michael Oliver is with me, and we'll be talking to him in just a few seconds. The financial war between America and China is escalating dangerously into a war to secure global financial resources. At a time of growing liquidation of dollar assets by foreigners, the U.S. Treasury's internal analysis will highlight future government funding problems in light of a developing U.S. recession. That will result in an over-dependency on inflationary financing threatening to destabilize the dollar's purchasing power. For these reasons, America needs foreigners to buy its treasuries at a time when China also needs to sell them to help finance her infrastructure plans and future development. And Alistair McLeod will be with us in the second half of today's show to focus on those topics and also how they connect to our markets in general. And right after our first commercial break, Sean Kuhn will be with me to give us an update on Strike Point Gold's hunt for gold in British Columbia's Golden Triangle. And he has some very important relationships that he's developed with other more advanced companies in that part of British Columbia. And we'll ask Sean to elaborate on those when we talk to him right after our first commercial break. But right now, Michael Oliver is with me once again. And it's OliverMSA.com, OliverMSA.com. Go there and check out Michael's work. I think if you are a serious investor, you want to consider subscribing to his newsletter. Thank you for joining me again, Michael.
Hi, Jay. Good to be back.
It is always good to have you. Every week, almost every week, we thank you so much for making yourself available because I find your work to be so helpful, and I know a lot of our listeners do as well. Gold has finally broken through that key resistance level of 1360. What should we look for next, and what might that mean for the markets in general?
Well, one thing that MSA does is we don't just look at one market. Like, unfortunately, a lot of people who are into gold are into gold, okay? And that's they're very focused on gold or silver and so forth. And you need to look out all the time. And this is also true with stock investors who are, you know, possessed of the idea you have to always be long the stock market.
Yeah.
And they're just looking at, a new high, you know, it's glorious, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. Look out the side mirrors and look out the rearview mirror, not just the windshield, because what other markets are doing is often important and telling.
Mm-hmm.
And what we've seen, not just the gold surge, which indicates a rush of new money into the gold market after we took out a very obvious price chart trend line that goes across the highs of the last 4 or 5 years, namely going through that 1350, 1360 level. And, of course, that created a surge, no surprise, and we're holding steady around 1400 right now. And we think it's going a lot higher, but we've got our eyes set on the possibility of 1520 area as a possible midpoint congestion zone en route mm-hmm. to something up into 1700s, mm-hmm. which we think this move will produce a move to that level. Mm-hmm. That's not the end of the entire move, but that's just the big leg that we think has begun. But mm-hmm. look out at the side mirrors, and you still see the investor asset class preference shift toward T-bonds, T-notes, and therefore creating lower rates in the process. That may not last a long time, but right now that is definitely a clear trend, and it's indicating that somebody doesn't quite believe in the stock market. Because they're shifting assets into T-bonds and T-notes and other government instruments around the world. Gold has obviously benefited lately. Gold miners have suddenly grown a backbone. The GDX price action is gone from the totally dormant, non-volatile to electrified. Mm-hmm. Just look at a chart, price chart of GDX over the last several months, and you'll see what most people would believe is unbelievable. It mm-hmm. came from total doldrums to with gaps and everything on the upside, and it's run from 20 buck area up to 26. Mm-hmm. And we think the GDX is probably headed for a challenge of the 2016 highs, which were 3190. So we think that's part of we're basically probably in a midpoint congestion in GDX and mm-hmm. out to that level. But the GDX has definitely swung from par to underperform versus gold to an outperformer. And we think that trend shift, which occurred in the last month, is the beginning of a major ongoing trend shift favoring gold miners over gold. What would that indicate? It indicates to us that there are a lot of asset managers and investors around the world who, while appreciating what gold has done, don't want to buy gold, they want to own the miners.
Mm-hmm.
Therefore, that is an indication of the investor preference shift. Out of the side mirror again, you're looking mm-hmm. at the relative performance of miners versus gold. The dollar is confusing to most people. They think it's a firm dollar. Well, firm is overdoing it a bit. It's sideways. Since August of last year, the dollar ran up. Dollar index ran up to 97 in price. And if you draw a line across August high of last year, so what are we talking, a lot of months, you're trading around 97 now. So
right.
It's twisted and turned either side of that level, teasing both sides. We think the big move is down. We think it began in 2016-17 early when we came from a high at $103.40, and now we're laboring in the upper 97s.
Mm-hmm.
Counter-trend rally is what we call it. We think it'll resume the downside. But take it into context, if you waited for dollar weakness to buy gold, remember August of last year, gold was at 1160 plus.
Mm-hmm.
Dollar index was 97. Well, the dollar's still at 97, but gold's at 1400.
Yeah.
If you're waiting on the dollar to give you approval to buy gold, it was you've misled yourself.
Yeah,
we think it'll be a late signal.
I would say so much for the idea of a stable dollar. It certainly doesn't buy nearly as much gold as it did a year ago. So
it does not. And other currencies, of course, throughout the world, the gold is
even worse,
rampaging against them.
Yeah.
So the side mirrors all indicate that something's wrong with the stock market, and I think that's what's going to help gold the most mm-hmm. in the coming months is the decay rollover in the stock market,
right.
the U.S. stock market in particular.
Right. Well, Michael, I understand that you're turning pretty bullish on the whole commodity complex again, not as selectively. You see gold leading the charge, I guess, right?
This is, I think it's an overlay of what happened between 1976 and 1980. Gold made a low in 76, started to turn up into 77, and commodities were about a year behind it. And gold led all the way up to the 1980 high, but the whole commodity complex exploded. And what was the world environment then? Stagnation.
Uh-huh.
You know, pathetic economic numbers. The stock market itself was a loser's place to be for nearly a decade, certainly during
yep.
those years. And the commodities, basically, you name the commodity, and it was vertical. But
yep.
it was led by gold, and it, all during the move, gold still outperformed the commodity complex. But right now what we've got is in the early part of the first part of the recovery in commodities from the 2016 low, crude oil and copper performed very well. But then they topped and they've collapsed back down, not to new lows, but sharply declined from the recovery highs. So they were both a positive and then a negative contributor to, like, the Bloomberg Commodity Index.
Mm-hmm.
Meanwhile, the grains were dormant all during 2016 through 2018 in a low price level range.
Mm-hmm.
But now the grains have resurrected themselves by our metrics. Soybeans a bit of a laggard, but corn and wheat clearly have. Sugar, coffee, and cocoa are looking good. Soft commodities, which few people look at.
Yeah.
The meat's affirmed. And we think that the copper and the gold negative implications are basically dissipated at this point. We think they're trying to bottom for a next up move, at which point they will contribute also a more uniform contribution to the commodity complex, because you'll
mm-hmm.
have grains going up, you'll have copper and crude oil turning back around and headed back up. We think that's something to look for in the next several months, not necessarily right now. But
mm-hmm.
the point being that if gold's leading a charge, that we need to see the troops organizing below it,
mm-hmm.
the commodity complex and all of its sectors,
mm-hmm.
Turning upward in unison, not in segments, which is
uh-huh.
the way they were in 2016 through 18. So we think
all
we're
right.
seeing that evidence of that now. In which case,
right.
you could make the case, welcome to 1977.
Oh, well, I don't know. I don't. That was a pretty unnerving time frame, as I remember, but that's when I got interested in gold shares. I have to tell you that, because I saw these little penny stocks go absolutely bananas to the upside. So, you know, it's an exciting
several
time.
Years.
It's not necessarily the best of times in terms of stability and all that. But anyway, it is what it is, Michael. And we're so thankful that you come on to help us realize what it is. So thank you so much for being with us again.
Thank you, Jay.
Always great to have you. Well, folks, we do have to go to break now, but don't go away. Sean Kunkun will be with us. He's the president of Strike Point Gold, one of our sponsors. It's a company that I follow in my newsletter. And it's also a company I think has a real interesting potential going forward as it explores for gold in the British Columbia's Golden Triangle. We'll be right back with Sean Kunkun.
Noble Resources Corp. trades on the OTCQX under the symbol NSRPF and on the TSX Venture Exchange under NVO. Its flagship assets are located in the Karratha region of Western Australia, where they are currently drilling and trenching their Perdes Reward Project. In addition, Noble has partnered with Sumitomo Mining Corporation to advance its Beaton's Creek Gold Project toward production. With over $70 million in cash and strong shareholder support from the likes of Kirkland Lake Gold, Noble is well on its way to establishing itself as one of the top junior explorers and developers in Australia.
Strike Point Gold, trading under SKP on the TSX and STKXF on the OTC, has a market cap of under $10 million. Strike Point is a new player in the Golden Triangle of BC and Canada. Focus will be on drilling the Willoughby Project in 2019. Prior drilling delivered over 20 meters of 25 grams per ton gold and 184 grams per ton silver. Recent receding glaciers have identified new gold targets. Neighboring projects have been acquired by Strike Point's largest shareholder, Ascot. Eric Sprott and Skeena round out the other top shareholders.
When When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network.
You're listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with your host, Jay Taylor. If you have a question or comment about today's show, Jay would love to hear from you at 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also send an email to questionsfortaylor@gmail.com. That's questions, the number 4, taylor@gmail.com. Now, back to our program.
Welcome back to Turning Hard Times to Good Times. I'm your host, Jay Taylor, and I'm really glad to have with me once again Sean Kuhn-Kuhn. He's the president of StrikePoint Gold. StrikePoint trades in Canada under the symbol SKP. You can buy it down here in the United States under the symbol STKXF. 88.6 million shares. It was trading earlier today at around 13 cents in Canadian money. That's 11.5 million market cap, or 8.6 million in U.S. money. So as you can see, it's just a real baby company, but it's a company that has some properties in a very prolific, gold prolific area of British Columbia called the Golden Triangle. And I think it has a very exciting potential going forward. So I'm really pleased to welcome Sean to the show again. Thanks for joining me, Sean.
Thanks for having me, Jay.
You know, you were with me once before. But for the benefit of people that might not have heard you, talk a little bit about the mission, what your company's business model is, what you hope to achieve. You know, you are an exploration company, but just talk a little bit about your properties and what your goals are for this year, perhaps.
Sure. Yeah, so if we go back to 2016, 2016 marked two significant bottoms. One in the U.S. dollar-denominated gold price, the other on the TSX Venture Exchange, the principal listing exchange for StrikePoint. So as we put in those two bottoms back in 2016, myself and the board of directors that is StrikePoint set out to acquire projects. We thought it was a great time, a compelling time for low valuations in the precious metal space. So what we've done in the last 3 years is we've acquired over 25 gold and silver properties focused in northwestern BC in the renowned Golden Triangle area, which has got some of the highest grade gold deposits in the world. And we've also picked up a large portfolio of properties in the Yukon. And so we've spent the last 3 years acquiring, and also we've raised in excess of $13 million for those acquisitions, and also to explore and develop those properties. So my team is a group of professionals that is, mining engineers, exploration geologists, accountants, capital markets professionals. And the one commonality, the one sort of common characteristic that we all have is we've had a successful career at acquiring projects and moving them on to mid-tiers and majors. So we've got several directors and technical advisors that make up StrikePoint that have made a career of acquiring projects, in the $1 to $10 million range and moving them off for hundreds of millions, and in some cases in excess of $1 billion.
Well, that's good. The track record is always very important. And, of course, the individual bios are available, I guess, on your website for people to go and check them out, right?
Absolutely. And, I look at three simple things that makes a company successful. You need management. You need the project, but you also need the ability to raise money. And I think what we've demonstrated in the last 3 years, a very, very tough time for small cap junior explorers. We've executed, we've raised money, and we've acquired very relevant projects. And now it's a time to go out and add value to these projects. So we're really excited. We're focused on the Willoughby property, and we've got a new technical advisory committee that we've just put together that's made up of Rob McLeod and Ryan Waymark. And Rob and Ryan have recently come over from IDM Mining that was recently acquired by Ascot Resources. They're helping us develop the Willoughby asset.
Okay. You know, one other thing, Sean, I would add another ingredient to a successful team, a successful exploration company, not only raising money, but who you raise the money with. And I notice as I look at your the ownership of your company, first of all, management owns 12%. I always like to see that, skin in the game by the people that are aligned with my interests as an investor. But you also have Eric Sprott is there for 8%, Skeena has 8%, Ascot 12%. And so it's only about 30% in the hands of retail, which I think means that you're, even though you have 88 million shares, first of all, if you have some discoveries here, this stock could go pretty rapidly, could rise north pretty rapidly, I would say. But also you want to know that you have people that will stick with and hold those shares through some difficult times if there are some. And you're not looking for someone that's going to make a quick buck in and out of a stock. So to me, that's a very important thing. I don't know if you'd want to comment on especially, I think, Ascot and Skeena. Do you see them as strategic holders of your shares?
I do, but you know, just generally speaking, like if you break down that 88 million shares, we've got 70% in the hands of long term oriented precious metals investors, and I think it is meaningful. Our largest shareholder is Ascot, and Ascot has spent the last 9 months. In that 9 months, they've acquired two of our neighbors. They've acquired the Silver Coin property from Jaden Resources, and they've acquired Red Mountain from IDM Mining. So we seem to have ourselves in an area where Ascot is looking to continue to be very active as they restart the Premier Mill and take their flagship Premier deposit back into production. And with our assets, Willoughby and Porter being in that vicinity, I think it's very, very strategic. But yeah, I can't say enough the fact that a company like StrikePoint with our valuation here has, you know, the likes of Eric Sprott, Gold 2000, U.S. Global. We've got some of the best precious metals investors under the sun as shareholders. So I think, you know, as we continue to go and grow and develop the company, we've got some very, very strong financial partners to help us move these assets along.
Sean, you just recently talked about a technical advisory committee. Can you talk about who is on that committee and what their mission is?
Yeah, so that committee is made up of Rob McLeod and Ryan Waymark. So Rob is a geologist who was recently the chief executive officer of IDM. IDM had recently combined with Ascot Resources. Rob's from the Stewart area. He was born and raised in Stewart, and that's where StrikePoint's properties are around. And Rob also was the VPX of Underworld, which discovered the Golden Saddle deposit in the Yukon, drilled out 1.4 million ounces, and was acquired by Kinross for $140 million. So Rob is he's a very creative exploration geologist, and he is going to be guiding our exploration efforts up in on the Willoughby property. And then we've got a very, very energetic young engineer in Ryan Waymark, who's got a lot of experience in this part of the world. And again, as we look to advance this project and build resources and potentially, upon success, make more development stage decisions, Ryan will help us go down that path.
Specifically this year, Sean, what are your exploration goals?
So As we move towards a drill program at the latter part of this month on the Willoughby property, when we look at Willoughby, the previous exploration has demonstrated some exceptionally high-grade results. So just looking at some of the high-grade holes here, 350 grams per ton gold over 3 meters. That included a 200-gram silver kick as well. So there's several high-grade intercepts that really stand out here. Although the property was, there was only two small areas of the property that were explored, leaving an opportunity to increase the mineralization along trend at along strike and at depth. So, our goal here is we're going to be going into an 8-hole drill program, and that 8-hole drill program is going to be looking at basically expanding the high-grade historic intercepts and looking to some western extensions and some depth extensions. Also, something to note here, and again, I don't want to get too technical here, but 2 years ago, there was a new geological interpretation that swept through the area that was essential and critical at some big discoveries at IDM. We believe that same folding that's occurring at the adjacent Red Mountain deposit, the post-mineralization high-amplitude folding that led to multiple new discoveries at the IDM project, we believe those new interpretations at Willoughby have the potential to lead to some significant discoveries.
Wow, that's
so
exciting.
We'll be looking to leverage that new those new interpretations with this new team.
Sean, when will the drill program get underway, and when might investors anticipate some results?
So we're looking to start drilling on the 27th of July, and we're looking at a program in the first phase that should take us till about the 11th or 12th of August. We're looking at potentially having results just after Labor Day.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, it's really something to be looking forward to, because you'll be drilling, I guess, close to some of those high-grade results from the past, right?
Yes, and you know what? When I look at the market, it's rewarded companies in the triangle for discovery news. So, if we go back 2 years to Garibaldi Resources that went from 7 cents to $6, or GT Gold that went from 30 cents to $3 on some significant discovery news, companies in the triangle have been rewarded. So, it is a really, really exciting time for us as we launch into a drill program here. This is the first time this property has been drilled in 25 years. And I think with the recent takeover activity and new geological interpretations, the new team, Strike Point is fully funded and ready to go. So it's a very, this is what you live for in this business.
No doubt about it. And you just raised $1.5 million, so that will take you through this 8-hole program, Sean, and take you through to the end of the year?
Well, yeah, the first phase of the drill program is budgeted for about $800,000. So we're looking at some phase two options right now. And, we'll be focused our drilling on the north part of the Willoughby property, the north zone. And then we're just working out some logistics for a second phase at the Willoughby zone.
Well, that's going to be really exciting. I'm really going to be watching
and
this.
Just to know, Jay, those two areas are over a kilometer apart.
Okay. So, I mean, scale is something we always want to see, of course. It's fine and dandy to find a small deposit. It's hard to make money with a public company with a small deposit. So what can you tell us about what you know about the scale of your target?
Targets? Well, this is an extremely high-grade system. So, unlike some of the lower grade counterparts, we don't need a property that is, the size of Texas. But what Willoughby is demonstrating here is there's 8 gold and silver mineralized zones that have been identified to date. There's about a kilometer of strike length that is demonstrating robust grades. So, our key is to try to build up resources along that 1 kilometer trend to start with, and then we can start building from there.
Wow. All right. Well, it sounds like something I'm going to want to keep my eyes peeled on, both for the newsletter and for my own account. So I want to thank you very much, Sean, for being with us, and look forward to keeping up with this story going forward. Thank you so much.
Thanks a lot, Jay. Thank you.
You bet. Well, folks, we're going to commercial break now, but don't go away, because Alistair McLeod will be with us. Really some very interesting things to talk about, the financial war as it escalates, what is that going to mean for precious metals and other markets? Alistair always has some great insights, so I hope you'll stick around and listen to what he has to say.
Auron Resources is a copper-gold exploration company pursuing the world's next major discoveries. It has seven projects, including two active flagships, Committee Bay in northern Canada and Sombrero in southern Peru. This summer will be one of the most exciting times in Auron's history as the company turns the drill at Sombrero for the first time ever. The project's impressive surface results have identified Sombrero as an analog to one of Peru's biggest mines. Auron is also implementing cutting-edge machine learning technology to unlock its highly prospective gold belt at Committee Bay. Visit AuronResources.com and subscribe to keep up with the company's busy year ahead.
A gold rush has begun. Recently, three of the largest gold mining companies announced strategic acquisitions in the Yukon Territories. Ahead of them was a group who had already consolidated the key claims covering the historic Klondike Gold Rush into one company, aptly named Klondike Gold Corp. Led by a team of accomplished geoscientists, the company is steadily advancing exploration to reveal the rich source of all that gold. The hunt for the next major discovery is well underway, and Klondike Gold's shareholders are strategically positioned. Stay ahead of the majors and follow KlondikeGoldCorp.com.
Voice America Business Network, the bottom line in business.
You're listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with your host, Jay Taylor. If you have a question or comment about today's show, Jay would love to hear from you at 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also send an email to questionsfortaylor@gmail.com. That's questions, the number 4, taylor@gmail.com. Now, back to our program.
Welcome back to Turning Hard Times to Good Times. I'm your host, Jay Taylor, and I'm really happy to have Alistair MacLeod with me once again. Backed by popular demand, and given the fact that I find his market insights so valuable to me personally, Alistair has been one of our most frequent guests, and he has worked as a stockbroker in the past, as a banker and an economist, and he is currently a senior fellow at the Gold Money Foundation and head of research at Gold Money. Thank you for joining me again, Alistair.
That's my pleasure, Jay.
You know, I'd like to tell our listeners before we go any further, they should go to goldmoney.com to catch up with Alistair's weekly missives, essays that he provides that I think are very thought-provoking and I think very correct in terms of his analysis of what is really happening in the markets. The underlying dynamics that might not necessarily be talked about that much in the mainstream, perhaps partly because people just don't have the attention spans to think through things, but Alistair's articles are very well written and easy to follow if you have an interest in really trying to understand why the markets are behaving the way they are. Alistair, I'd like to focus mostly today on your June 20th article titled "The Financial War Escalates." And in the introduction to that article, you stated the following. You said, and I quote, "Behind the scenes, the financial war between America and China is escalating dangerously into a war to secure global financial resources." So I'm wondering if you could give us some examples of rising conflicts that that are there to secure financial resources.
Well, we've known that there is a financial conflict between America and China for some time. And a lot of the reason that China, I think, has been building not only its own gold reserves, and I don't mean the sort of £10 a month that they're adding at the moment, but the more serious undeclared bullion holdings that they have, mm-hmm. which they've accumulated really between 1983 and the year 2002, but also the fact that they've encouraged their citizens to buy and invest in gold. And they've accumulated separately from that. I mean, I've seen estimates of about 16,000-17,000 tons. So you can see that the strategy from China's end is to take a very different view from America when it comes to fiat currencies. And at some stage, it is absolutely clear that they will intend to be completely independent of the US dollar. Now, the loss of that international role for the US dollar for 40 to 50% of the world's population, I'm talking about the whole of Asia basically, mm-hmm. Is a very, very serious matter because the Americans use the hegemonic status of the dollar as the means of financing their deficits. The deficits are financed very, very much by foreigners buying dollars rather than US citizens, if you like, saving and then putting money into US treasuries. And the problem that we now have is that there is an enormous slowdown in cross-border global trade. Now, that has been so sharp and sudden, I think it's that, you know, the figures are still coming out on that, and they tend to surprise on the downside. As well as that, of course, it is affecting domestic production for many countries, including America. Mm-hmm. And the effect of that is that if you get a very severe economic downturn, which I have argued is going to happen because you've got a combination of the end of the credit cycle, and after the end of the credit cycle, you get a credit crisis. And on top of that, you have almost a Smoot-Hawley Tariffs Act come credit cycle ending twin, the other twin being 1929 to 32. Now, obviously, we hope that what happened then doesn't transpire this time, but I think there is a very serious danger that there is going to be a very substantial downturn in the global economy and also in the US economy. The effect of that is that the budget deficit in the United States will increase very substantially. Now, this gives the Americans a problem, because the foreigners are no longer buying dollars. And the reason they're not buying dollars is quite simple, and that is they don't need them. They've already got an enormous quantity. I mean, if you look at the total of their investments in U.S. treasuries, property, real estate, equities, corporations, that sort of stuff, plus their cash on deposit, which is around about $4.5 trillion, you're looking at a total of over $22 trillion, which is roughly the GDP of the United States. So the myth that everybody has been talking about, there's a shortage of dollars and all the rest of it, is simply not true. There are too many dollars in foreign hands, and when things start going wrong, the foreigners start selling their foreign currencies. It's as simple as that. Not because mm-hmm. they don't like the dollar, so necessarily, though I mm-hmm. would argue that people like China really don't like the dollar, mm-hmm. but principally they just don't need them, and they need to have their financial resources back at home, protecting their home base. So you mm-hmm. can see that in those economic conditions, you know, the sort of the flows that have been going out of every country because of the prospect of increased trade and all the rest of it start reversing. Now, at this time, as I said earlier, you will find that the budget deficit starts accelerating quite substantially, and you could easily be looking at revisions. I mean, I think the current year's budget deficit is expected to be around about $1 trillion. Mm-hmm. In a full year, that's going to go up to over $1.5 trillion, and it's going to look like that for some time. So what happens under those circumstances? Under those circumstances, America has to do something to attract the portfolio flows back into the dollar. Mm-hmm. And it does that by trying to trash the regions where those flows go. And that brings us to China. China has this plan to invest an awful lot in her own infrastructure. And indeed, throughout the Asian continent with the Silk Roads and all the infrastructure that goes with that. So China needs to attract foreign currency through Hong Kong, through the Shanghai Connect link into China and also into the Asian, I can't remember what it's called now, the Asian Infrastructure Development Bank,
yes,
which they set up in Shanghai. So China needs those funds. America needs those funds. That basically is the battle that we face.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not going to be, you know, it is a severe escalation of the situation, which we've had over the last 3 or 4 years.
Okay, so it's going to, something's got to give, and I want to get into some of the dynamics of what you talk about in your article that's going on there. But just as an aside, of course, Alistair, 2008, 2009, there did seem to be a dollar shortage when the system went into a reverse, when we had the financial crisis. And you know what happens when you have something like that going on? The margin clerk calls for the loans to be repaid. Everybody has to sell whatever they can, whatever is liquid enough to sell. And the dollar got stronger relative to other currencies during that time frame. Of course, once they started QE, it reversed. But isn't there the prospect of that happening first, where you might see a collapse in prices and a stronger dollar?
On a credit crisis, what you say is true. There is a heavy degree of liquidation. But what you were describing was essentially a dollar shortage that was occurring in America. What we're now looking at this time round is the foreigners have added a lot to their dollar investments and their mm-hmm. dollar cash, and I don't think they're quite in the same position to be squeezed, if you like, as mm-hmm. happened last time. I think the best way to look at it is you have described exactly what was happening internally in America. Mm-hmm. You had the U.S. banks trying to call in loans from American residents, American citizens. I'm sure on the margins there were foreign borrowers of dollars in the same situation, but that was not the basic problem. The basic problem was in America. I think people who talk about this a lot seem to think that Turkey, for example, can only borrow in dollars because their own currency is rubbish, and nobody will go and buy Turkish lira in order to lend money to the government. So when you get a problem with the Turkish lira, then obviously people start talking about, well, you know, they owe an awful lot of money in dollars. It's going to cost them more lira to get those dollars back and so on and so forth. Now, that is the sort of crisis that you can get. And that is part of the strategy. And this is from the Chinese point of view rather than my point of view. But the way the Chinese look at it, and they've observed these cycles going all the way back to the Latin American crisis in the 1970s and the late 1970s. Uh-huh. They have seen basically it's a sort of buy, puff up everything and then dump it type strategy. And basically, there comes a point where America wants all that money back for her own purposes. And what she does is she will crash another economy. And the example of the Latin American economies, I mean, they all crashed at more or less the same time. Southeast Asia, again, all crashed in 1997, 98, I think it was. And why? It was because money was going back into the dollars. Now, we all assume as observers that money going back into dollars was basically money which, for various reasons, had become too speculatively involved in, let's say, the Latin American countries or, indeed, Southeast Asia. But the way the Chinese look at it is basically, that's not quite it. What happens is the Americans pull the rug out from under mm-hmm. and cause the flight to go back into the dollar because they need the investment resources to fund their budget deficits. Now, it's an interesting point of view, and I can't argue too strongly against it. I don't unreservedly accept it. But the point is, that is what the Chinese think, and this is why we should pay attention to it. It was something that their chief military strategist came up with, and mm-hmm. He informed the Chinese leadership and the army exactly what these tactics are. So mm-hmm. that is what they expect. That is what they see. So they are on high alert to protect themselves. And mm-hmm. from their point of view, they see the riots, the demonstrations in Hong Kong. the initiative, if you like, of the American intelligence services. Mm-hmm. Why? Because they want to stop the Chinese Connect working. They want, if you like, international portfolios to take their money out of China and redirect it at America. That is the Chinese's suspicion. And mm-hmm. so we have to pay attention to how they think about this particular matter.
Mm-hmm. Well, if we look, Alistair, whenever there is a war or a crisis or whatever, countries are, when there's risk involved in investing in a certain area, if you can create chaos in that market in those countries, then the capital that's there is looking for a safe haven. They're looking for a place to get out. And what is more liquid, what is more solid, it seems, among all the fiat currencies of the world than the U.S. dollar, right? So it makes some sense. Maybe that's what's going on in Iran, perhaps, as well?
Well, I think that is certainly a possibility because, they stir the pot in Iran, as it were, which again puts people off putting money into, say, infrastructure in Saudi Arabia or helping to rebuild some of the nations that the NATO allies have destroyed, like Iraq, like Afghanistan. Now, Afghanistan's another interesting one because, of course, you've got enormous untapped resources. So there's an extra reason why we all want to stay in Afghanistan, and that is to keep the Chinese out of Afghanistan.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And getting hold of all that wonderful gold, silver, and everything else there is there. So this is something that's going on in the background, and I think that the Occupy Central thing in Hong Kong back in 2014 failed to tip the balance. It did actually cause the Shanghai Stock Exchange to fall very, very sharply.
Mm-hmm.
But now we have the same thing being played again. It hasn't been finished. The Chinese have backed down on the bill to take criminals back into China. The extradition bill.
Uh-huh.
That's now been put on hold. So the Chinese, I think, are trying to play this one very, very carefully. They want to be strong, but at the same time, they have to be a little pragmatic. So it's interesting. And of course, the whole Huawei thing is all part of this, too. America's been running around telling all her allies, don't under any circumstances do business with Huawei. And, the excuse is quite simple, that they say that it gives them the ability to spy on you. Now, I don't know about you, Jay, but if I have a Huawei mobile phone and it works extremely well, I'm not sure that the Chinese are going to get any mileage out of spying on me. But once you sort of put the thought in everybody's head, of course, you can see what happens. It's mm-hmm. Very destructive of business.
Yeah,
and this is very important because they've got a leading role in 5G, and so that's another aspect of it. America does not want to see Chinese technology overtake American technology.
Right, right. No, that's right. It's all about monetary. It's all about material power, global power, and so forth. I guess, isn't it? And to what extent do you believe the Chinese are in fact building up their military capabilities?
I think I'm sure they are. I don't think they have any intention of entering into a military conflict. But you can see that it's rather like a game of chess, isn't it? You move your pieces, if you like, to protect a particular area. And the particular area that we can see being protected is the South China Sea. I think that China would like to exploit that a lot, and I suspect that their long-term planning is, first of all, secure the shipping routes, as justifying thereby the building of these defense positions on the various reefs, which are claimed variously by Japan and the Philippines and so on and so forth. And I think the next stage will be they want to start exploring for oil in the South China Seas, and they will claim those new bits of territory, if you like, should be taken into account in any international treaty carving out the area, if you like, of exploration in the South China Sea. So you can see, yes, they're pushing the boundary the whole time. That is the way of it. I think that America is very worried about losing its influence in the region. So yes, I mean, you're bound to get a build up of military capability, I think, as the background to that, because we all know the basic rules of not having war. You know, basically, you talk pleasantly but carry a very big stick.
Right. Yeah. So. The oil, how important is oil because of the petrodollar? I mean, mostly the United States wants to retain, I don't know if Trump understands this, but certainly the U.S. power has been able to be expanded since we went off the gold standard by using this dollar that we could create out of nothing, the petrodollar, as it were. And so to what extent does it seems like wherever there's oil, it tends to be more military conflicts, more international conflicts. So you mentioned oil in the South Chinese Sea. You mentioned, Afghanistan and their minerals and so forth. I know there's some, a lot of minerals there that haven't been exploited. What is China going to do, though? And I mean, how do you see this thing being resolved, Alistair?
Well, I don't really see it being resolved. I'm afraid that the financial war is likely to escalate even further. And if I can pick up your point about energy is actually fundamental to everything.
Sure.
The deal which basically Nixon and Kissinger put together with the Saudis back in 1973 was, we'll let you, price oil as you want. We can't stop you. We can't stop you doing that.
Right.
But the one thing we will insist is that you take payment in dollars.
Right.
And what that meant was that every oil payment was lodged with a U.S. bank. They called them money center banks in those days.
Mm-hmm.
And those banks that could then recycle those dollars for other uses. And a lot of them, of course, went into pockets of the generals in the Argentine and all the rest of it. And that was what led to the boom, if you like, the financing boom of South America and the subsequent collapse of South America. And a lot of those dollars also went into funding the growing tendency for the U.S. budget to run in deficit.
That sort of helps explain now why the oil price went bananas after that in the 1970s. As a matter of fact, it'd almost be to the benefit of a strong dollar to have a higher oil price, because that would mean more dollars would be demanded around the world to buy oil from OPEC, right?
Yes, that is correct. I mean, it seems bizarre, but this is really at the heart of what has been described as the Triffin dilemma.
Yeah.
Basically, you need rubbish policies to support the status of an international currency, and that, of course, is what America has been doing ever since the Nixon shock in 1971.
So you don't see a resolution anytime soon. With just about 3 minutes or so left to go here, how is this going to impact as this war continues to accelerate and I guess get worse? I mean, we can hope and pray there's no hot war, there are hot waters. The U.S. is involved with dropping bombs everywhere, it seems. I mean, wherever they feel they want to change a regime or whatever. Trump seems to be pushing back a bit on that. But what's this mean for our markets? That's the bottom line as far as we're concerned here to a great extent. What's this mean? You mentioned China's been importing and building up its gold reserves. It's the largest gold producer in the world. Russia's joining as an ally of China. We're forcing the two together closer and closer. Iran, Turkey, possibly some of these countries. What's all this mean for? I guess what you're really concerned about is an enormous amount of money printing that could result in a substantial amount of inflation, so that tangible assets might rise in value relative to a declining currency. Is that the bottom line?
At the end of the day, but it's going to be a very rocky road before we get there. I mean, look at property, for example. Most property is financed by borrowings. Yes. And if you have an inflationary collapse, the first thing that happens is that people can't afford to repay their mortgages, and so property prices collapse. Now, there does come a point, obviously, where you should start picking up property and so on. But by far, the best asset under those circumstances is gold, sound money, silver perhaps, as well. And there is another thing that's happening, and that is that the millennials are buying into a new story, and that is Bitcoin in particular.
Right. Right.
I don't know that Bitcoin is going to last forever. I would certainly not claim for that. But I think it could actually make the next credit crisis quite a bit worse, because it provides an escape route. And it's also educated an awful lot of people who otherwise wouldn't have been educated about the downside of fiat money, fiat currency, and why it is likely to collapse. So it's a very interesting and complex situation developing, but basically go for sound money.
Okay, and real quickly with 30 seconds left here, Alistair, silver, you indicated before we went on the show that you're going to be writing an article on silver. Give us your quick thoughts on silver. Why is it not participating with gold?
I think this is fascinating. The article will be published on Thursday. I don't think I got time to go into it, so I would ask your listeners to
just to go to goldmoney.com.
Gold Money Research Insights, and you'll find it there from the afternoon US time on Thursday. But basically, I think I have managed to uncover what has been happening in the silver market, and I can tell you that there is someone who has built up a huge position, long position, and a lot of the big boys in the market who have gone short against this, effectively they're short against this big position, don't actually understand what's going to happen to them.
All right, we'll have to leave it go at that. Thank you so much. It's goldmoney.com, folks. You want to go there and catch Alistair's article. That's all the time we have this week. Next week, my main guest will be Jim Rickards, who will discuss his latest book titled The Aftermath. Peter Talman of Klondike Gold will be with me, and hopefully Michael Oliver will join me once again as well. Until then, goodbye and God's blessings to you.
Thank you again for listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with Jay Taylor. Please join us again next Tuesday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel.